Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Should carefully think about whether they want to take the risk of giving another vaccine to their child.
A CDC panel votes to stop recommending that all newborns get a hepatitis B shot.
It's Friday, December 5th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, the aftermath of an immigration surge in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Some parents kept their kids out of school at the height of the operation.
They had notes pinned on their backpack that says, I am a citizen. I would never think that that's something that I would see.
Plus, Spotify gives users a personalized recap of their year in music, including their so-called listening age.
It creates just another shot to the system for us to talk about. If you're 20 and your listening age is 70, what does that say about you?
Yeah, and should you share it? First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Ukrainian and American delegations are meeting in Miami in an attempt to advance peace in Ukraine after talks between the U.S. and Moscow earlier this week. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports the sides are still far apart on key issues like eastern Ukrainian territory partially occupied by Russia.
Ukraine still holds on to a little less than 30% of Donetsk Oblast, but it's a key fortified belt that includes several cities with people who want to remain in Ukraine. Russia wants Ukraine to hand it all over. Ukrainians fear the U.S., in its quest to seal a deal, will pressure Kyiv to abandon Donetsk. Russia is making incremental gains in eastern Ukraine, but lost 25,000 soldiers in the month of October alone. Ukraine's commander-in-chief, General Oleksandr Sirsky, says Kyiv's strategy is to exhaust the Russians and prevent their advance. Sirsky says he does not even allow himself to consider a scenario in which Ukraine would be forced to give Russia the entire Donetsk region. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
The Pentagon has created a new army command at Fort Bragg. As Jay Price reports, it's part of the Trump administration's increase in foreign policy focus on the Americas and border security.
It's called the U.S. Army Western Hemisphere Command. During the ceremony marking its creation, its first commander, General Joseph Ryan, said building it the right way was crucial for the nation.
When we succeed, we will be proud to serve in a theater army that is ready for the myriad tasks that our nation's priority theater requires.
Creating the command is in line with the new national security strategy the White House released this week. It says the United States will prioritize dominance in the security and economics of the Western Hemisphere. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price at Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
The New York Times and the Chicago Tribune have filed copyright infringement lawsuits against AI company Perplexity. NPR's Bobby Allen reports.
Lawyers for the Times say Perplexity rips off the newspaper's stories verbatim and answers it generates for users of its chatbot. The Chicago Tribune filed a separate lawsuit alleging similar behavior that the paper says represents copyright infringement. In a statement, Perplexity says publishers have long sued new tech companies, quote, "Fortunately, it's never worked, or we'd all be talking about this by telegraph." The Times found that in some instances, Perplexity will attribute false facts to the paper, known as hallucinating, which the Times says has hurt its reputation. According to the Times suit, it tried over the past 18 months to reach a licensing deal with Perplexity to no avail. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Next year's Men's World Cup is set after a ceremony in Washington, D.C. The U.S. will face Australia, Paraguay, and a European playoff winner in the group stage. Argentina, home of superstar Lionel Messi, will play Algeria to open it. NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. California Senator Adam Schiff is among a growing group of Democrats to condemn Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. Hegseth's use of the messaging app Signal, which led to a leak of highly classified information earlier this year, is under scrutiny, as is his role in the killing of men who survived a U.S. military strike on a boat in the Caribbean. Here's Schiff, who spoke today at an event in San Francisco.
His poor leadership at the Pentagon has resulted in now what may very well be a war crime. How is it possible the United States is killing two people clinging to a sinking vessel? That is strictly prohibited by the laws of war. he should be held accountable and he should be gone.
Lawmakers viewed a video of the boat strikes in a closed-door briefing yesterday with sharply divided reactions. Many are calling for the video's release. It's day two, and the West Contra Costa teacher strike appears to be set to continue for now. Teachers and the district leaders have met for negotiations in hopes of ending the strike, but the two sides can't even agree on how the meeting went yesterday. The district superintendent issued a statement saying the meeting was productive and progress was made, but union president Francisco Ortiz says the meeting was brief and the district was late and they showed up with no written proposals.
So we let them know that we're prepared to negotiate with them when they have something that is written down that we can consider. Right now, there doesn't seem to be any urgency.
District officials did not respond to follow-up questions. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay, in theaters December 12th. And from the listeners of KQED. And support for KQED comes from Peninsula Lively Arts, presenting Hip Hop Nutcracker, a spin on a holiday favorite with beloved music and fresh moves, December 20th at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. at the San Mateo Performing Arts Center. Details at peninsulalivelyarts.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In a historic vote, vaccine advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have stopped recommending that all babies get a dose of the hepatitis B vaccine at birth. The vote was contentious. It is strongly opposed by most of the medical community. NPR's Ping Huang has been watching. Hey, Ping.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Okay, so this is the CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee. What prompted them to change the policy?
So earlier this year, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. dismissed all the previous members from the panel, and he handpicked his own, many of whom, like Kennedy, have long questioned the safety of vaccines that have long been in use. Mm-hmm. So the hepatitis B vaccine is among the first vaccines they're reviewing on the schedule, and the committee cited concerns from some parents and also said that other comparable countries don't give hepatitis B vaccines so early. Here in the U.S., they've been recommended for all healthy newborns for over 30 years, and that policy is credited with dramatically reducing liver disease. Since the 90s, annual Hep B infections in infants and children have dropped by 99%.
And yet they've voted to stop all vaccinations?
To stop recommending it for every baby, they still recommend it for babies whose mothers test positive for Hep B or whose status is not known. But now, mothers who test negative should talk it over with their doctor. Some members who support the change did it for parental choice. Here's Retsef Levy, a professor of operations management at MIT.
The intention behind this is that parents should carefully think about whether they want to take the risk of giving another vaccine to their child. And many of them might decide that they want to wait far more than 2 months, maybe years, and maybe up to adulthood.
But a CDC official pointed out that this has always been a recommendation and not a vaccine mandate. Still, Levy was one of 8 members who voted for the change. There were 3 members that opposed it. Pediatrician Cody Meissner from Dartmouth said it went against his oath as a doctor to do no harm.
Thoughtful inquiry is always commendable, but that inquiry should not be confused with baseless skepticism.
Many medical professionals also spoke against the vote at the meeting.
Okay, just to emphasize, this was a vote by the advisory committee. It's not binding, so what happens now?
Yeah, so now it's up to the CDC's acting director to decide whether to accept the guidance as policy, and that's a move that could take hours or weeks. We're not sure yet.
Got it. Hey, beyond the committee, beyond the CDC, how are folks you're speaking to responding?
So many in the medical and public health communities are very upset about the vote, and they're worried about its likely impacts on health. Now, that is even though with this change, the hepatitis B vaccine should still be covered for free for any parent who wants it for their child. But Dr. Sue Wong, a physician in New Jersey and a hepatitis B advocate, says it will sow chaos. Fewer babies will be vaccinated.
In years down the road, we are going to see that really nice decline we had with getting acute hepatitis B and chronic hep B cases down, we're going to see it go back up again. And we're going to see rises of liver cancer. And so this is really a travesty.
Those in public health also see it as part of a broader push by Secretary Kennedy to undermine vaccines and discourage people from getting them, even though the evidence in the safety record has not changed. There are signs of that in some of the other topics there.
Other topics. Okay, give me one or two sentences on what other topics were.
Yeah, sure. So the panel heard from Aaron Seary, who's a lawyer who's suing HHS. He questioned the safety of many common childhood vaccines and called for ending vaccine mandates. Mm-hmm. And they also questioned the safety of aluminum-based additives to vaccines that have been used for almost 100 years.
And Pierce Ping Huang. Thank you, Ping.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration's aggressive immigration crackdown has arrived in New Orleans and Minneapolis as federal agents continue expanding their dragnet for undocumented immigrants. This follows a recent strike in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hundreds of Border Patrol officers descended on the city November 15th, arresting about 400 people in a week-long operation. The enforcement surge there appears to be over, but as NPR's Adrian Florido reports, Charlotte is still grappling with the fallout.
It's the end of the school day, and a yellow school bus pulls up outside an apartment complex in East Charlotte that is home mostly to immigrants. About 10 elementary school-aged children hop out. There are no parents to greet them, as there normally would be. The kids walk and run the rest of the way home alone. It's just one way that life looks different in Charlotte in the aftermath of the Border Patrol's operation here last month.
It's like a hurricane came through.
Stephanie Sneed is chair of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Education.
We're still not quite sure if the storms are completely over. And then we have to deal with the aftermath, which is much longer than the event itself.
At the height of the operation last month, about 20% of the district's 141,000 students stayed home. Parents have started sending them back, but with precautions, Sneed says.
They had notes pinned on their backpack that says, "I am a citizen." I would never think that that's something that I would see.
The economic impact is also still visible everywhere. It's visible in the shuttered Mexican food truck owned by a woman who asked that we ID her by her first initial, E, because she's undocumented. E and her family were preparing meals in the food truck when, on November 14th, they saw on social media that a large Border Patrol convoy was driving toward Charlotte. They panicked.
Cuando nosotros vimos eso, en ese momento agarramos, cerramos la traila y dijimos no más.
We closed the truck and we said no more, E says. They rushed home and locked themselves in. The next morning, she watched on TV as federal agents started nabbing people off the streets and raiding construction sites. 3 weeks later, E still will not step outside her house. She doesn't believe the Border Patrol agents who swarmed the city are actually gone.
Pues ellos están esperando el momento que nosotros salgamos para que ellos nos casen como los gatos, el gato y el ratón.
They're waiting for us to go outside again, she says, so they can hunt us like a cat hunts a mouse. Charlotte has been one of the nation's fastest growing cities for more than two decades, in part because it became a banking center. Tom Hanchett is a Charlotte historian.
In the 90s, Bank of America built the tallest building on our skyline, and the story is they hired a steel-setting crew from Texas. And there were a lot of Hispanic people and a lot of Mexican natives standing up there on that steel looking down going, well, it's a pretty nice place. It's got a booming economy, and maybe we could, you know, try to make it here.
And they did make it here. Today, about a fifth of Charlotte's population is foreign-born. Many Latino immigrants here work in construction, hospitality, and own small businesses. Manolo Betancur is one small business owner. He's from Colombia. He's owned a popular Latino bakery here for 28 years. I meet him on the now empty sidewalks of Central Avenue, usually bustling with foot traffic.
This avenue is always packed. All the time, you know, go to the laundry, go to the grocery stores, come to the restaurants.
On the morning the Border Patrol arrived, he was walking to his bakery with his U.S. passport in his pocket when an SUV stopped half a block ahead of him. What he saw is seared in his mind. Agents jumped out, tackled three men who looked Latino, zip-tied their wrists, and hauled them away.
And I just turned around and I saw a lot of people that were coming in
like
this
walking,
way.
Like walking this way,
families. Yeah, walking this way, families. So I just turned down and I told them, they're here, and just go back to your house, go back to your house, and everybody started running.
He called his employees and told them to lock the bakery doors. Later that day, he announced online that he was closing Manolo's bakery.
I don't want for people to tell their kids, I'm going to go to the bakery to get your birthday cake, and then that kid never going to get her father back or her mother back.
Casey Crimmins runs Project 658, which provides services to immigrants in Charlotte, including medical care. When he saw Manolo Betancourt on the news saying he was closing shop, his heart dropped.
When it's in Chicago, when it's in L.A., there's scrollable shorts. When it's Manolo, who I literally had just seen 4 days before, saying to a camera, I've never seen anything like this before. I have to shut down my shop. It just hits different.
He and others in the community sprung into action, alerting people about raids, helping kids get to school, delivering food to immigrants' homes. Crimmins says residents want to show that this is still a welcoming city, a reputation forged on hard-earned trust.
This brought a sense that all of that that was built up over decades got flushed down the toilet.
Yeah.
Two employees of a medical clinic his group oversees, Lindsay Velker and Mary Beth Stanford Picker, are out delivering medicine and food to an undocumented patient.
Estamos aquí afuera de su casa con sus medicamentos y la comida también.
The patient is an older woman from Honduras. Okay. She requested that we use only her first initial, R. The week Border Patrol was in town, she says, agents roaming her apartment complex knocked on her door two different times.
Como hay un hoyito, ahí se ve. Entonces yo vi que habían dos.
She recognized their beige uniforms through the peephole. She stayed quiet and they left, but she is still struggling to sleep. R cares for children while their parents are at work. Her income plummeted when people stopped bringing their kids. Today, she's only caring for two kids. She walks them to school, but she stopped using the sidewalk and started walking through the woods.
Un caminito, yo misma abrí con un machete el caminito. Unas ramas que habían ahí.
She cut a path through the brush with a machete. They won't find me in there, she says, with a nervous laughter. Daniela Andrade is with the Carolina Migrant Network, an advocacy group. She says Charlotte won't be back to normal until people feel safe again.
Because it's very hard to say, oh, they're gone and let's live, go back to normal life. It's really hard to, right now in these moments of crisis and fear in our community, to tell folks to trust.
Instead, she and other advocates have been telling people not to let their guards down. Adrian Florido, NPR News, Charlotte, North Carolina.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
NPR examines the roots of Sudan's civil war next on All Things Considered after your traffic update, starting with trouble on the Dumbarton Bridge. Here's Steve Herrera.
Hi, Michelle. Lots of heavy traffic on the Dumbarton Bridge, eastbound 84, right around the high rise. A three-car pileup impacting the right lane. Lots of bumper-to-bumper traffic driving into San Francisco on the Bay Bridge. Just solid from the end of the parking lot to the metering lights, and more slow and go from the island to 101. And still working that crash eastbound and westbound 92 from Ox Mountain to Skyline. All lanes are blocked. Steve Herrera, 4KQED.
Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from Silicon Valley Community Foundation, raising urgent funds needed to support local nonprofits as low-income residents' access to food, shelter, health care, and other essential services is at risk. Learn more at svcf.org. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, announcing the Season of New Traditions event going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at Kia.com.
Hey, I'm Sam Sanders, and I'm happy to say that I am back in the Bay. The Sam Sanders Show is coming to KQED on Sunday afternoons. I'll keep you up to date on culture, talk with the people shaping today, and bring a little bit of joy to start your week. From big ideas to good laughs, the Sam Sanders Show is just the conversation you need to wrap your weekend. Join me starting December 7th here on 88.5.
I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on Political Breakdown, we'll be in San Jose, where some of the leading candidates for governor participated in a forum sponsored by the California State Association of Counties. Among those participating, billionaire climate activist Democrat Tom Steyer and Republican Steve Hilton, a former Fox News contributor. We'll dissect highlights of the forum as the field of candidates continues to grow. It's Political Breakdown on KQED News at 5:50 today. And wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. Subaru. The Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And from the listeners of KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland Sacramento.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Sudan has been at the center of a brutal war since April of 2023. It's the site of the world's largest hunger crisis. More than 4 million people have fled the country since war broke out, and the World Health Organization estimates at least 40,000 people have been killed. Rund Abdel Fattah and Ramtin Arablouei, co-hosts of NPR's history show Throughline, tell us the story of how things got so bad.
The roots of today's war in Sudan go back over a century, from British colonial rule to a cycle of revolutions and coups that started after Sudan gained independence in the 1950s. In 1989, that cycle turned once more. A man named Omar al-Bashir took control of Sudan in a coup, and as soon as he had power, he turned his attention to trying to keep it.
For decades, he ruled with an iron fist. The average Sudanese person suffered. The economy was poor, and people struggled to find food to eat.
The protests against Bashir started, unsurprisingly, in the periphery.
This is Khulod Khair. She's a Sudanese political analyst who runs a think tank called Confluence Advisory.
December 2018, a bunch of school children who were protesting that their sandwiches at school were too expensive.
The government's response was swift and harsh.
The government has been using live ammunition and tear gas to disperse the crowds.
And very quickly that caught the hearts and minds of many, many people.
The protests spread throughout the country. A mood of possibility was in the air.
Demonstrators who've been met with live bullets and tear gas say they want President Omar al-Bashir's nearly 30-year reign to end.
At the beginning, things were very rosy.
This is Ibrahim El-Badawi. He's a Sudanese economist.
And the army switched loyalty to the public, declared that it's actually going to support the revolution.
Hemeti and General Burhan, as the kind of two most powerful military figures in the country, worked together to kick Bashir out.
This is Christopher Townsell. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Washington, who focuses on the history of modern Sudan. Burhan was a top general in Bashir's armed forces. Hemeti commanded the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. And Christopher says that after Bashir fell, it seemed like both generals would do as they'd promised and cede their power to a new civilian government.
I arrived just one day earlier, before the massacre.
2 months after the triumphant moment of Bashir's fall, Ibrahim al-Badawi came to Khartoum. He was there to support protesters who were staging a sit-in outside the army's headquarters because the generals had not ceded power. They met the protesters with force.
We're being attacked by the Rapid Police Forces and the police.
There was a sense of despair, actually. And the whole country was just devastated.
The Khartoum massacre in June 2019. Hemeti's Rapid Support Forces opened fire on civilian protesters, killing more than 100. Many more were beaten, raped, and violently detained. And the military, led by Burhan, watched it all happen, right on its doorstep. This was the same military and the same RSF that had seemed so eager to support this democratic revolution a couple of months earlier, to help the starving and impoverished and turn Bashir's 30-year rule over to the people. But now, Burhan and Hemeti had turned on the people.
But then, shortly after, this triggered a massive outpouring of protest all over the country. And so eventually they were forced to negotiate with the leadership of the revolution.
Ethiopia and the African Union stepped in to help Sudan set up a transitional government that would eventually hand off to a civilian elected administration, finally bringing true democracy to Sudan. Both civilians and military officials were chosen to serve on the transition council. Burhan and Hemeti each had a seat at the table. It helped that the U.S. and other Western powers lifted sanctions on the country.
Opportunities were open to Sudan, big time. Debt relief, political openness, and so on.
At first, that seemed to work for Burhan and Hemeti.
But I do think, though, that they were reluctant partners.
Reluctant partners, who in hindsight, he says, had never actually committed to the idea that the military would hand power back to civilians.
Some Sudanese, they call it a creeping coup.
In 2021, with the country moving closer to the day when the military was supposed to hand control of the government off to civilians, Hemeti and Burhan decided their time had come.
Sudan was moving toward democracy, but then today the military arrested the transitional government's leaders and put the acting prime minister under house arrest.
Burhan took over control of the country, and both generals were amassing wealth and power. But even as they appeared to be working together, the two men were on a collision course, because there was one big thing they couldn't agree on.
And this was the future role of the Rapid Support Forces.
The paramilitary force Hemeti still controlled.
Whether the Rapid Support Forces would be incorporated sooner or later into the army. Burhan wanted it to be incorporated sooner, 2 years. Hemeti wanted it to be 10 years. It would obviously kind of protect him longer.
Neither Burhan nor Hemeti was willing to budge.
And that would put the country on a path to this tragic war.
What happens in April 2023 is the beginning of the trauma and the hellscape.
And then once the fighting broke out, it could never be stopped.
There's one more layer to this conflict, and it's the most tragic one. Khulod Kher says both generals, Burhan and Hemeti, actually share a common enemy in this war, the people of Sudan, and the dream of democracy many have held for decades.
It is a war against civilians. And so while they are fighting each other, they're also fighting the civilians of Sudan, who they recognize as the true change agents in the country. And what's interesting about Sudan's history, that has such a long history of armed conflict, there's always been non-violent action by a large proportion of different groups of Sudanese people that have brought down military dictatorships.
That was Sudanese political analyst Khulod Kher, Sudanese economist Ibrahim El-Badawi, and University of Washington professor Christopher Townsell. You can hear the full episode on the war in Sudan and more from Throughline hosts Ramtin Arablouei and Rund Abdel Fattah wherever you get your podcasts.
This is NPR News.
KQED News with Natalia Navarro is coming up after your traffic update, including a crash in Pinole. Here's Steve Herrera.
Hi, Michelle. Traffic is snarled up in Pinole, eastbound 80 at Pinole Valley Road. A car and an SUV have mixed it up in the left lane. In San Jose, northbound 87 at Kirtner Avenue, be alert for a wreck in the center lane and brake lights for days. Eastbound 84 at the Dumbarton High Rise, a three-car crash block in the right lane. Steve Herrera for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Stay Healdsburg, home to a holiday collection of festive events and immersive experiences. Learn more at aseasontosparkle.com. And from Berkeley Rep, presenting Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, a ghost story told by Jefferson Mays, a special one-week engagement through December 21st. More info at berkeleyrep.org. Did you share your Spotify Wrapped listening age? You fell into the trap. Details are still ahead in this hour of All Things Considered. It's 5:30.
From KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. A handful of candidates hoping to be the next governor of California were in San Jose today. They debated in a forum held downtown and then toured one of the city's tiny home communities for the unhoused. KQED politics correspondent Guy Marzorati was with the candidates and joins us now from San Jose. Tell us about the candidates forum. Who was there and what did you hear from the candidates?
Yeah, this forum was at the convention center. It was hosted by the California State Association of Counties, which represent the 58 counties at the state capitol. Our colleague Marisa Lagos hosted the forum with six candidates, and they kind of broke into a few different camps. You had former Attorney General Javier Becerra, the state superintendent Tony Thurman, and then the former controller Betty Yee. They've all had experience at the state capitol in statewide office, and they really touted that in a lot of their answers. Tom Steyer, an investor, and then former Congressmember Katie Porter, who were a little bit more willing to kind of call out state government and the establishment at the Capitol for lack of progress on affordability, both housing and energy affordability. And then there was one Republican, Steve Hilton, a commentator who definitely stood out in his group as he blamed Democratic rule for a lot of the state's problems.
How about the candidates who were not in attendance?
Riverside Sheriff Chad Bianco and then East Bay Congressman Eric Swalwell, they were not at the forum. Swalwell's been the big name most recently to jump into this race, and he really vaulted up the polls after he jumped in, probably because voters remember his name. They know of him and his work in Washington in the national spotlight, certainly battling with President Trump during his first administration, was part of that impeachment effort, even though Swalwell doesn't have a ton of experience at the state level.
So there's a lot of candidates in the mix here, and I know you tagged along with a number of them after the forum for this tour of the tiny home community in South San Jose. What did you hear from them there?
Yeah, so this was a tour hosted by San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan, who took the candidates to this tiny home community that just opened recently on Cherry Avenue. And this is really the centerpiece of Mahan's time as San Jose's mayor, shifting city money away from building permanently affordable apartment buildings to building these tiny homes and more temporary shelter. And Mahan has not endorsed a candidate in this race, but it's clear he's trying to build support from whoever the next leader of the state will be for, you know, the ongoing costs of running these interim housing communities.
Where do the candidates stand on this idea of investing in short-term housing like these tiny homes?
Well, two of the candidates that I spoke to, Katie Porter and Tom Steyer, they both said the state should be putting more emphasis on these temporary solutions. Here's what Porter said.
Permanent supportive housing takes time. It takes a lot of resources. That goal shouldn't mean we don't make the progress that interim housing can let us make now.
And this has been really controversial both at the city level in San Jose and at the state, where I think critics of Mahan's interim approach have said spending money on these tiny homes is taking away money and would be better used if it was for permanent kind of long-term housing for people.
We're about 6 months away from the primary election. Where does the race stand right now?
It's been many, many years since we've had a governor's race like this, where they're just this close to the primary has not been a clear front runner. And I think what today's forum showed was that these candidates have all spent months and weeks talking about Donald Trump, talking about how they want to fight Trump as the next governor. They haven't spent that much time talking about what they would actually do in the years after, you know, if they are governor, in the years when they're governor after Trump, and what they would do on a lot of these state level issues. That will all have to be fleshed out in the months to come.
All right, we'll be following it. Thank you so much, Guy.
Thanks for having me.
That was KQED politics correspondent Guy Marzorati, and I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Support comes from Postman, used by 40 million developers to build APIs that help AI make smarter decisions. More at postman.com. Support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting Apocalypse in the Tropics. The documentary by Petra Costa investigates the fast rise of the evangelical movement in Brazil and the consequences for politics and democracy. Now on Netflix, awards eligible. And from VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. Support for NPR comes from EBSCO, supporting open source technology and making open platforms possible for libraries of all sizes. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From ARM, on the latest episode of Tech Unheard, ARM CEO and host Renee Haas talks to Jayshree Ullal, CEO of cloud networking company Arista Networks, about how tech and AI are helping to shape the future of computing. And from the listeners of KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland Sacramento.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. In a blockbuster Hollywood deal announced this morning, Netflix said it's buying the vast studios and streaming properties of Warner Brothers Discovery. CNN and other cable channels owned by Warner Brothers are not part of the deal, but this would create a global entertainment and streaming giant. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is here with more. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, David, Netflix is already the world's leading streamer, so why does it want or really need to buy Warner Brothers?
Yeah, and let's underscore the fact this is a departure for Netflix, which has not been in the business of acquiring. It's been in the business of building or licensing content for itself. I think it's a signal Netflix wants to be the everything store, the Amazon of entertainment, right? That they are going to, they're already the world's leading streamer. They're already a dominant name in American streaming, and that they want to essentially blot out the landscape as others are trying to grapple with them. So they're putting together the Warner Brothers movie studio plus HBO, you know, one of the great brands, and HBO Max, whatever name it's going by on any given day. Put that together with Netflix. They promised to continue to release Warner Brothers movies theatrically in theaters, but it would give it huge control over entertainment content. Some of the iconic hits coming under the same umbrella, Game of Thrones franchise, Harry Potter from Warner Brothers, and Squid Game. You know, these are elements of huge things that keep people coming back again and again.
I mean, Discovery and Warner Brothers are some of the biggest names in the industry. How could this change the shape of Hollywood?
Well, it's allowing Netflix to have access to, you know, all the intellectual property of Warner Brothers as well as their future things, assuming this deal goes through. You know, if you think of other franchises, there's Looney Tunes, one of the totems of my youth, but also the DC superhero franchises, right? And Warner Brothers has, in some ways, surprisingly, had a lot of successful movies lately, but Hollywood has been sculpting itself around the challenge that Netflix has posed. So you saw Disney not too many years ago acquire most of Fox's entertainment holdings to bulk up and supersize. You've seen Comcast and Paramount thinking that they would have a strong chance. In Paramount's case, they thought they had the inside track to acquire Warner Brothers studios and streaming services so that they could elevate from being CBS and NBC and Paramount and Universal respectively, combine it with Warner Brothers and take on Netflix. Netflix is saying, no, we're going to supersize the supersizing. This is a behemoth, a colossus bestriding the world of entertainment should it comes to pass.
I mean, anytime two companies are in the same businesses merge, there's a big if. There are these antitrust concerns. How hard do you think it'll be for Netflix to actually get this approved?
Well, so let's talk about this in two ways, one of which is the conventional notion of antitrust, and that is the amalgamation or the combining of too many things that are of a like kind in ways that can distort the market for other players in the market, distort the market for consumers. After all, people are already shelling out, you know, in the teens of dollars each month for Netflix and for those who also subscribe to HBO Max for that. What leverage would this provide Netflix to raise that cost, I think you're going to see the antitrust division of the U.S. Department of Justice, which is led by somebody who takes a keen interest in these matters, really give a hard look at, does this concentrate too much power in the industry in this way? And you're seeing state attorneys general have questions about that and become more, shall we say, aerobic and muscular in thinking about antitrust issues of late. And you're also likely to see that, to be honest, in Europe, in the European Union. Let's talk about Trump world. President Trump plays an outside role in all of this, even though conventionally presidents aren't supposed to weigh in on these kinds of decisions. Donald Trump made clear that he thought that the path should be eased for the Ellison family, that his father and son, Larry Ellison, co-founder of Oracle, one of the richest humans on the planet, one of a handful of the richest people on Earth, and David Ellison, his son, the head of Skydance, who engineered just this year the takeover of CBS's parent company and Paramount's parent company, now called Paramount Global, merged that with Skydance. He was thinking, we're going to take all of Warner Brothers Discovery, all of their studios, all of their content, all of their cable properties, pump up Paramount, we're going to take on this. They're going to try to challenge this in a variety of ways, they've signaled, and we're going to see how that goes. The question of what Trump wants matters these days. His Justice Department clearly takes its cues, so I think that's going to be a real second strain to that question.
And David, the one thing we haven't really touched on is those cable properties you mentioned. What happens to CNN and the other cable properties if this deal does go through?
So as Comcast did with its cable properties, these would be spun off, presumably so someone could purchase it. The people who you think might be most interested might be the Ellisons. After all, they just acquired CBS and have been thinking about CBS News, might want to fold CNN in. But it is making these places vulnerable. It's not clear what their future holds.
NPR Media Correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
Spotify Wrapped is here, offering users a personalized recap of their year in music. This time around, the streaming platform is also calculating their so-called listening age. As NPR's Rachel Treisman reports, it's not necessarily what you would expect.
This week, I found out I'm 70 years old. At least that's my listening age, according to Spotify. That's because I listen to a lot of 70s music, like Billy Joel's The Stranger, 21 times. Then I felt the stranger kick me right between the eyes. For the last decade, Spotify has ended every year with an interactive recap of each user's listening habits. It usually includes their top songs, artists, albums, genres, and listening time.
Spotify Wrapped is by and large an identity project for its consumers.
That's Marcus Collins, a professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business, and an R&B fan with a listening age of 40 and a love of Boys to Men. It's become the norm for listeners to share their Spotify stats on social media.
It's a way by which we're able to project our identity based upon our cultural consumption.
Your listening age offers another way to do that, especially if it's multiple decades off your actual age.
It creates just another shock to the system for us to talk about. If you're 20 and your listening age is 70, what's that say about you?
Spotify is relying on a concept called the reminiscence bump, which says adults feel most connected to music from their teen years. So it looks at which five-year window of music you listen to more than your peers and does the math as if you were a teenager during that era.
For instance, for me, I still always return back to 90s R&B and 90s hip hop. It jettisons us back to a time when we were sort of figuring ourselves out.
Those calculations can yield some pretty dramatic results if the social media memes are any indication. Songwriter Gracie Abrams' listening age is 14, about half her actual age, while electropop artist Charlie XCX clocks in at 75. Collins says this kind of shock value works to Spotify's advantage.
Because we don't talk about the things that are just boring. You know, we talk about the things that are unbelievable.
So is Spotify rage baiting us for free publicity, or is it giving us a helpful way to connect?
The truth of the matter, it's both of them at the same time.
Collins, like many of us, learned about Spotify Wrapped's release from social media, not paid advertisements.
Then I said, oh, I want to know what mine is so that I can engage in the discourse, not because I love Spotify so much, but because I want to participate in the social practices of my people.
And that's a tale as old as time. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Ganges River in India is a sacred place in Hindu traditions. People put their loved one's ashes in its waters as a final rite. But what happens when a family can't make the trip to India? Rose Schnabel with WUFT tells the story from Florida.
Growing up in South Africa as an Indian woman during apartheid wasn't easy for Vasanthi Doshi. She was born in 1942. She found comfort in music and sang from a Boy Scout songbook. She especially loved a song about the Swanee River by Stephen Foster.
Way down upon the Swanee River.
This Bing Crosby rendition came out in her childhood.
Somehow we just all wanted that song first. Very sad song. But with the sadness comes this hope that things will be better.
Today, the original 1851 lyrics are viewed as racist. They depict an enslaved person nostalgic for their days on a plantation. But to Vasanthi, now 83, the song meant something else, the chance to be far away from apartheid's reach. She got that chance after she married in 1970 and eventually moved to Florida after visiting college friends there. One day, her husband, Paresh, entered an auction for a run-down motel in Old Town, Florida, and won. The rooms backed up to a river.
It was not very visible at that time, you know, because of the overgrown foliage and the trees and all that. But I stepped out to the dock. There were steps going down to see how it was laid out. And I said, wow, what a spot.
He kept the river a secret from his wife, Vasanthi, who was angry at his real estate purchase.
I told him, you cannot buy that property. And he said, you just have to come one time tomorrow.
So she did. And it was Paresh who led her to the river.
So he's in the front pulling me, and I didn't want to go. Went on. It took a while till I got to the end.
But then she saw it, the Swanee River.
What God does for us, we have no idea.
A few years later, when Vasanthi's dad passed away, she invited a dozen Indian families over for a funeral ceremony on the river.
They were shocked that I was doing that, and then started calling me.
Their motel has now become a gathering place for families who can't travel to the Ganges for funerals. Vasudha Narayanan directs the study of Hindu traditions at the University of Florida. She says Hindus believe sprinkling a loved one's ashes in the Ganges liberates the soul from the body. And local rivers often become a substitute.
They know it's the Swanee or the Mississippi. They do think it is infused with the sacrality of the mother of all rivers, which is the river Ganga from India.
Vasanthi has started calling the Swanee River her Ganga. People come from over 100 miles for the funeral ceremony. Her daughter Sapna gives a demonstration.
So what we're doing right now is lighting the lamp to put the boat in the water in memory of anyone who's passed.
The paper boat carries flower petals to make the soul's journey sweeter. Sometimes families scatter ashes in the water too, which Florida law doesn't regulate. But today, Sapna just watches the boat drift away in the heart of rural Dixie County, down here upon the Swanee River. For NPR News, I'm Rose Schnabel in Old Town, Florida.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Political Breakdown is coming up after the KQED News Quiz, but first, let's get your traffic update, starting with a crash in Pleasant Hill. Here's Steve Herrera.
Hi, Michelle. Traffic under the speed limit in Pleasant Hill, northbound 680 at Monument Boulevard. A two-car crash taking away the left lane. You're out of crawl here in San Francisco, northbound 280 from Cesar Chavez to King Street. And a recurring overturn crash in Half Moon Bay has both directions of Highway 92 shut down between the Ox Mountain Landfill and Old Kenyatta Road. Steve Herrera for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction, Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, where a commitment to pure ingredients and sustainable brewing meet a legacy of craft since 1980. Sierra Nevada, taste what matters. Please drink responsibly. And from Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. Okay, it's now time for the KQED News Quiz question of the day, and today's question is, KQED News reported this week on a plan to install speed cameras in 18 locations in what Bay Area city? Submit your answers at kqed.org/radio-news-quiz for a chance to enter to win.
Richmond R&B, Oakland hip-hop, San Francisco punk. Bay Area artists really delivered this year when it comes to music. I'm Nastia Vainovskaya, editor and reporter at KQED Arts and Culture. We rounded up 20 of the best Bay Area albums of 2025, and you can read all about them at kqed.org/arts.
It's KQED News. I'm Natalia Navarro. At a forum in San Jose this morning, some of the top candidates for governor participated in a discussion sponsored by the California State Association of Counties and moderated by KQED's Marisa Lagos. On today's political breakdown, hosts Scott Schaefer and Lagos and politics correspondent Guy Marzorati dissect the highlights of the forum.
Let's talk about today's forum. This, of course, was the very first appearance by Tom Steyer, who just announced he was running. Notably absent, I might say, Eric Swalwell, who also recently got in. I thought, you know, he was the one who made news today, talking about perhaps wanting to do that split role idea with Prop 13, commercial property now covered by the limits in tax, property tax increases.
I am proposing to close the corporate real estate tax loophole that has been on the books for 50 years, which enables them to pay $10 to $15 billion per year less than is reasonable.
Is that going to fly? Is that an idea that has legs, do you think?
I mean, I think it certainly speaks to the lane that Steyer wants to and does occupy in this race, which is very progressive and sort of, you know, on the side of a lot of the progressive ideas in terms of single payer. You know, Prop 13 is sort of seen as a third rail in California politics. We have voted on it before. There was an unsuccessful measure to sort of split that off and make it so you could assess higher taxes on commercial properties. So I think it makes sense. I think he wanted to make a little bit of a wave today. You know, they're all trying to get attention. This is really the first open governor's race in a couple decades, in a way, right? I mean,
wide
that's
open.
Before Schwarzenegger. And so I think for someone like Steyer, who does, as you say, have that history of using his billions of dollars towards political causes, largely on the progressive left, it very much makes sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, Steyer will have his challenges. Californians do not always elect billionaires running for office. He hasn't had successful campaigns in the past individually running for president. Here's what I think he does kind of have going for him is what happens next year if voters are still upset, still frustrated, still anxious, still looking for someone to blame. It's a difficult thing for Democrats in California once you get past blaming Trump. Who else is there to blame, to turn to be a boogeyman? I think you see a lot of Democrats, even today, folks like Javier Becerra, Betty Yee, Tony Thurman, who have been in the Capitol, struggling to articulate that. They're not going to run against Gavin Newsom. They're not going to run against Democrats in Sacramento. And Tom Steyer, you know, for all his warts, he's identified boogeymen. He's called out breaking up the utilities. He wants to raise taxes on corporations. And so is that, you know, a platform for him to be effective in this race? And we honestly heard that from Katie Porter, too, mm-hmm. today, calling for change. She called out Sacramento at a few different times. I wonder if that's a limiting factor for some of the candidates who have spent their careers in Sacramento.
Absolutely. Although I will say Javier Becerra, who, of course, was in Congress for many years, then he was attorney general appointed by former Governor Jerry Brown. He was the first one to really address the room, which was counties. And he was talking about the cost of uninsured people coming into county hospitals. I thought, and he did that a couple times, I thought, where he really spoke to the concerns of people in the room. But, you know, he also has talked about, as he did today, running big organizations mm-hmm. and that you can't just hire somebody to be governor who's never run anything before. And I think you could say, you know, that might be a knock on Katie Porter, for example.
Or the two businessmen on stage, not just Tom Steyer, but Republican businessman and former Fox contributor Steve Hilton, who, you know, I think they're both going to talk a lot about their business experience. But as we know, the business sector is not, you know, the private sector is not government. It's a very different sort of set of challenges and realities. To your point, Guy, I mean, Meg Whitman spent over $100 million trying to run for governor against Jerry Brown and came up short. That feels like chump change these days with the amount of money we're seeing spent on campaigns. And so, you know, I think what you really see today, and look, this was a policy forum, to your point, Scott, for a group of county leaders. And, you know, we're going to have all these folks on our show and talk about the politics of some of this and push them on some of these things. But I will say it was interesting to me how, you know, there was a lot of agreement, quite frankly, on the stage. There was a lot of, with the exception of Hilton, obviously, a lot of, to Guy's point, sort of like, I think trying to thread that needle of being a little critical of the status quo without acting like they're part of it slash throwing all their friends under the bus, who, you know, they're all texting constantly to try to get their endorsement.
Well, and Steve Hilton, interesting needle to thread there, because he talked about how great California is and the entrepreneurial spirit and, you know, the California dream. And yet he thinks the state is in a toilet.
We have the highest poverty rate in the country, the highest unemployment rate. The budget, I think I'm right, Betty, in saying in the last 5 years, gone up from 180 billion to, what is it, 320 billion plus. We have tested to destruction the idea that spending more money, taxing more, spending more leads to better outcomes. The outcomes are the worst in the country.
One thing he didn't talk about or mention is Donald Trump, and I think that's, you know, clearly going to be a limiting factor, although he would love to get that endorsement to get into the top two.
You know, yes, he can get maybe the 40% of Republicans if he can consolidate that, but do you think Californians will be buying what he's selling in terms of change? Because he's talking about rolling back climate initiatives. He's talking about sort of urban sprawl as the key to increasing our housing and reducing.
Yeah, that was new.
That was like, whoa, like he was like
obsession with infill housing.
Against not just infill, but building up. And I think that's kind of counter to what we've seen as the sort of prevailing political narrative around those issues.
Yeah, look, the thing with him is he's a Republican. Republicans are going to have a very hard time winning a statewide contest in California. I do think you will likely see a Republican make it into the top two if President Trump makes an endorsement and plays kingmaker in this race. It's difficult, though, to run for a statewide office and say, I'm running because everything is great. Everything's awesome. You know, I just want to continue that along. So I still haven't heard from a lot of these Democrats where they will separate themselves from the administration, what they'll do differently from Newsom. One interesting question you asked, Marisa, was on homelessness and whether the balance
maybe
between...
Maybe help me craft that question,
you know,
Guy Marcera.
The balance between spending on permanent affordable housing and interim shelter, which is, we're here in San Jose, that's been the main thrust of the mayor here, Matt Mahan's tenure, is to shift money towards temporary housing. And Katie Porter, interestingly, said the balance is off in her mind. She wants to see more money spent on short-term housing.
We need to devote funds to multiple kinds of homelessness solutions. That means funding for interim housing that can be put up quickly, and that we hopefully, when we begin to build more housing and housing costs come down, we won't need as much homelessness housing.
And so looking as this kind of plays out, where do we see more Democrats, I guess, try to draw at least some of those contrasts with what has been the status quo in the state?
Well, in terms of housing, and there's a robust conversation about housing at the very beginning or near the beginning of the conversation today. And, you know, a lot of changes have been made just in the past few years on CEQA reform and infill housing and building more density, going higher up near transit corridors. And, you know, I think maybe one or two of the candidates acknowledge, like, hey, we've cleared away a lot of the problems, the things that have stopped housing from being constructed. And, you know, even Steve Hilton, you know, I think he avoided that. But the fact is there's been a lot of change.
That was KQED's Scott Schaefer, Marisa Lagos, and Guy Marzorati. You can hear the rest of their conversation on the Political Breakdown podcast. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, a story of love and loss that inspired the creation of Shakespeare's Hamlet, directed by Chloe Zhao, now playing in theaters everywhere. The Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals whose ideas, solutions, and discoveries expand people's expectations of what's possible, macfound.org, and from the listeners of KQED. And we'll have more news from Natalia Navarro coming up in about 2 minutes. Right now, let's get your KQED traffic update, starting with a crash in Livermore. Here's Steve Herrera.
Hi, Michelle. It's a rough Friday getaway eastbound 580 before North Livermore Avenue. There's a two-vehicle fender bender impacting the center lane. In Petaluma, northbound 101 at the old Redwood Highway, I see a wreck in the right lane. And eastbound Highway 84 at the Dumbarton High Rise, a three-vehicle pileup taking away the far right lane. Steve Herrera for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa at Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Kaiser Permanente, where their doctors, hospitals, and health plans are designed to work together to help their members live healthy lives. Kaiser Permanente, a better idea for healthcare. New research finds that traffic congestion has not only bounced back to pre-pandemic levels, it's reached record highs. That story is ahead in the next part of All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Hennigan, and this is KQED.